Once upon a time, in an age of forests and firelights, our ancestors were wise to the spectrum of human identity. Among the fairy tales and myths they told were stories of glass coffins and marble statues, eunuchs and androgynes, chaste marriages and bodily transformations, symbolic stories that hint at other identities, tales of asexuality. This is the Asexual Fairy Tales Podcast, and I'm your storyteller, Elizabeth Hopkinson. Each month, I'll be reading you another story from my books of asexual fairy tales. Some of these are old tales of myth and legend, in which I first found representation for my asexual identity. Others are original stories by me, based on traditional motifs. It's a personal selection, but I hope you find something in it that speaks to you too. So, sit back, if you are able, relax, and enjoy another asexual fairy tale. Hello and welcome back to Asexual Fairy Tales. It's good to be with you again. Today's story, The Man Without Desire, is a bit longer than most, but bear with us. It's actually from a little-known silent film from 1923 starring Ivan Novello in the title role. The story is by Adrian Brunel from an idea by the Irish playwright Monckton Hoff, and it tells the story of a man who sleeps for 200 years and awakes without desire. In the film, the same actors play the 18th century characters and their 20th century descendants, creating a sense of mirroring. The story seems to draw on Robert Browning's poem At a Carter of Galuppies, which is quoted on the title pages of the film, and says, "As for Venice and her people, merely born to bloom and drop, here on earth they bore their fruitage, mirth and folly were the crop. What of soul was left, I wonder, when the kissing had to stop?" The story has the feel of a literary fairy tale. It is in part a gender-reverse Sleeping Beauty, and uses many of the motifs found in the glass coffin and the half-marble prince. From an asexual perspective, it is problematic, but deeply fascinating, and I've been fascinated since I first saw the film. And this retelling is by kind permission of the Moving Image Library. Was there ever a city that conjured up the spirit of romance like Venice? Venice, where doges wed the sea with rings. Venice, where beauty wore a mask, and the dagger lurked beneath the cloak. Venice, where fortunes were staked in the ridotto, courtesans were richer than queens, and castrati made women swoon. And was there ever a setting so contrary to the Venetian spirit of romance than an English gentleman's study, with its brown furniture, its scent of leather and cigars? Yet here sat Professor Robert Maudersley and his three companions, awaiting the stroke of midnight. "Gentlemen, you may wonder why I have summoned you at this hour," Maudersley said. "The fact is, I have received instruction about a sum of money left me by a distant ancestor, and a letter to be opened at this precise date and time, in the presence of a reputable lawyer, a physician learned in the arts of both East and West, and a representative of the bank." With that, the hour struck, and the seal was broken. Maudersley drew out a large sheaf of papers dated from the year 1736. "This looks to be a lengthy story," he observed, "but as it has not been told for almost 200 years, we ought to give it our full attention." The three settled in their armchairs as Maudersley began to read. "There was in Venice, in the year 1733, a young count named Vittorio Dandolo. He had fallen deeply in love with the beautiful Countess Leonora Almoro. Every night, like the troubadours of old, he would serenade her beneath her window. But Countess Leonora was a chaste wife who would never dream of betraying her husband. Vittorio begged Leonora to let him be a friend to her, nothing more. He worshipped her, but he would do nothing to harm her honour. Not so the Count. Like the libertine he was, Count Almoro was conducting an affair with a celebrated beauty known as La Foscolina. Nor was his dalliance a secret, for all his pretences at clandestine meetings. Indeed, it was the gossip of Venice, reported in a thinly veiled fashion by the Venice Gazette. The editor had it all from a maid in Almoro's household, who was the editor's lover. When Almoro saw the newspaper report, he was incensed. He had men seize the editor and subject him to the cruelest punishment. The fingers that had dared write about the Count were to be crushed. Seeing them maimed and useless, said Almoro, would be a worse fate than losing them. The editor staggered from Almoro's dungeon into the arms of his sweetheart, vowing revenge. Leonora begged her husband to end the affair, for the sake of their child, if nothing else. But this only outraged Almoro further. "How dare you lecture me? I am lord and master in this house," he bellowed, and flung Leonora to the floor. Leonora could not help but compare such behaviour with that of the gentle Vittorio. Desire was kindled in her heart, and though nothing but kisses passed between them, each longed for a way out of this dreadful situation. It so happened that, living in Venice at that time, was an Englishman named Simon Maudsley, a scientist. One night he was set upon by thieves outside his door. Vittorio was walking home from the Ridotto at that hour, and hearing the cries for help, hurried to the rescue. He chased the thieves away with drawn sword and carried the swooning Maudsley into his shop. What bizarre sights met Vittorio's eyes! Strange liquids bubbled in flasks, giving off pungent scents. Skeletons, skulls, and the skins of strange beasts crowded on shelves or hung from walls. Vittorio had never seen a room like it. Seating Maudsley in a chair, he searched around for a drink to revive the man. He drew aside the curtain and was met by a truly horrifying sight. There was an open coffin with a man lying inside it. "What was that?" he stammered when he finally got a drink to Maudsley's lips. "Behind the curtain, I saw..." But the scientist was too shaken to reply. "Another time," he waved his hand. "You will come again?" "Of course," Vittorio promised. When next he saw his new friend, Vittorio was shocked to see the man, who had lain in the coffin, walking about and helping Maudsley to mix his potions. "But I saw him," he said. "He was in there." "Yes, he was there for 6 weeks," Maudsley smiled. "Suspended animation is my latest experiment." "But how can that be possible?" "Why should it not?" Maudsley said. "There are accounts of yogic trances going on for days or even weeks. Bodies have been found preserved in bogs, fish preserved in ice. Open your mind, Vittorio. So much is possible to the man of science." But Vittorio had other matters with which to occupy his mind. Leonora was desperately unhappy, but how could she ever leave her child? "Don't lose hope, my love," Vittorio wrote to her. "I will find a way to free you, I promise." He sealed the note with a kiss and went to Palazzo Almoro, hoping Leonora's maid would give her the notes. But when he arrived, another man was with the girl. It was the newspaper editor, come to take his revenge on Count Almoro. He gave a vial of poison to the maid, instructing her to slip it into Almoro's wine. Vittorio trembled at the news of the plot. Could this be his hoped-for chance? He handed the maid his note, and she went inside the palazzo, leaving Vittorio and the editor to wait in suspense. Count Almoro was in a foul mood. La Foscolina had been nagging at him to prove his love to her, and all his wife did was sob and weep at him. He toyed with the decanter the maid had brought, watching the light glint from its glass stopper. The scent bottles on his toilette table glinted back, reflected in the expensive mirror. His eyes narrowed. He could see a reflection in the mirror. The maid was watching him, peering through the curtains as though she expected something to happen. In 3 strides he crossed the room and seized her by the elbow. "Why are you spying on me? This is some plot, isn't it? Tell me what's going on, or by God—" A note fell out of the girl's bosom. Almoro snatched it up and read, "Vittorio Dandolo, and my wife, Leonora, come in here now. What is the meaning of this?" He thrust the paper in his wife's face. "You plan to betray me with that fop, Dandolo? How long have you been his concubine? I would never—" "Almoro, please, think of our child," Leonora begged. "And why is your maid spying on me? This wine is drugged, isn't it?" "I don't know anything about it." Leonora was shaking. "In that case, you drink it," said Almoro. "Then we'll know the truth." Leonora's maid ran to the courtyard, where Vittorio and the editor were waiting. "Quick, quick, my mistress is about to drink the poison." Vittorio ran as if the hounds of hell were behind him. But it was too late. As he burst into the chamber, Leonora breathed her last and collapsed into his arms. He carried her to the couch and laid her upon it as gently as if she had been sleeping. Then he turned to Almoro, who was standing, numbed, by the empty wine glass. "Murderer!" Vittorio screamed. He no longer knew what he was doing. All he knew that was Leonora was dead, and Almoro was to blame. Before anyone could stop them, the two men had their hands around each other's throats. Vittorio's rage consumed him. His hands were a vice that wouldn't let go. Almoro convulsed one last time. His pulse ceased. He fell dead upon the floor. Vittorio staggered back, horrified by the scene. He fell to his knees by Leonora's couch, kissing her beautiful, dead face. The maid grasped him by the shoulder. "You must flee, my lord, before they find you here." Unthinking, Vittorio ran. His legs carried him to Simon Maudsley's house before he even knew where he was. Maudsley pulled him inside and locked the door. "Oh, you must help me." Vittorio collapsed into a chair and began to weep. "My dear friend, whatever is the matter? Here, drink this." Maudsley fussed around like an old nurse. Vittorio gave a groan. "Leonora is dead." He poured out the whole tale into Maudsley's ear. "You must give me something to kill this pain. Surely among all your potions and experiments—" Vittorio gazed around at the bubbling flasks and vials. Maudsley plucked at his lip. "There is something we can do, and I think you know what it is. You can take part in my greatest experiment by undergoing suspended animation. By the time you wake, this trouble will have blown over, and you can begin again. But I've never put anyone under for such a length of time. I cannot guarantee it will work." Vittorio glanced around, as if he'd already heard the watch pounding on the door. "I'll try it," he said, "but in case it doesn't work, give me something that will end my misery for good." They exchanged solemn glances. "Very well," said Maudsley at last. He fetched a small vial and put it in Vittorio's pocket. "Only to be used in extreme need," he said. He led Vittorio to the coffin. The sight of it filled Vittorio with horror, but he was too weary to contemplate another alternative. He lay down in the narrow casket. "I must warn you, friend, that if this works, and you awaken after your long sleep, it is likely you will not be the man you were. Your body will live, but your soul will pay the price. Life may seem empty, bland, colourless. It is even possible you may find yourself without desire of any kind." "I care not." Vittorio closed his eyes. "What use is desire without Leonora?" Maudsley nodded. He held out his arms and began the mesmeric gestures that would bring on the charmed sleep. In the gentleman's study, Robert Maudsley's guests shifted in their leather chairs. "You don't mean to say this Dandolo chap is still alive? It's been nearly 200 years. The doctor rubbed his chin. "Theoretically, it is possible if the body is still intact. And you have money for the enterprise. I say we go to Venice." They arrived in a city that had seen better days. but whose canals and crumbling palazzos still spoke of former glories. With the help of the old letter and some locals, Professor Maudsley and his doctor friend found the site of his ancestors' old shop. The secret chamber had been walled up, but workmen soon tore down the wall. Maudsley and the doctor clambered over piles of old bricks into a darkened room whose only feature was a coffin on a raised platform. "This is it, then," said Maudsley with a shiver. Together they heaved the heavy wooden lid. Beneath it was a second lid, made of glass. Through it they could see a face in repose, a man's face, delicate and attractive, framed by a powdered wig. "Good God, it's him," Maudsley said. They removed the second lid, and the doctor consulted the sheaf of old papers. Carefully he encountered the words and made the gestures, as faithfully as possible to the written text. Then he stood back. "I expect it will be some time before he fully awakes. I say we withdraw for a while. Go to that little cafe across the street for a drink. The sight of modern people at the moment he opens his eyes could be too much of a shock for him." Vittorio was left to awaken on his own. At first he couldn't think where he was. His head was groggy. His legs were weak. He stumbled from the coffin, leaning on the wall for support. He had come to Maudsley's house. But where was Maudsley? He peered across the rubble and brick dust. The shop was deserted. Vittorio rubbed his face, trying to think. Leonora! Had that all been a horrible dream, or had she really died in his arms? He must know. Staggering from the shop, he hurried to Palazzo Almoro. It was still inhabited by the family, although their fortune had dwindled since Vittorio's day. The door was unlocked, and Vittorio raced upstairs to the salon. He glanced around him. The room looked different. Ugly little tables cluttered up the floor space. The stucco was cracked and peeling. A curtain parted, and a woman came into the room. Vittorio's heart leapt to his throat. Leonora! He rushed to take her in his arms. She was not dead after all. It had all been a hideous dream, and now they would never be parted. "What are you doing? Get off me! Who are you?" The woman pushed him away, furious. Vittorio stared at her. She had Leonora's face, but Leonora would never have worn her hair so short and frizzy about her neck, or her dress so scandalously revealing. "You're not Countess Leonora Almoro," he said. "Where is she?" "What do you mean, where is she?" The woman looked at Vittorio as if he was insane. "She was my ancestor. She's in the family crypt, of course." At that moment, Maudsley and the doctor came bursting in. "So sorry about our friend, miss. We should have known he'd come here. He's not been well." And with that, they took Vittorio away to begin his new life in 1923. There were many things Vittorio found astonishing about his new world. Matches, motorboats, telephones. Yet, so much of it seemed drab by comparison to the life he knew. In his new apartment, Maudsley and the doctor persuaded Vittorio to abandon his silk stockings and knee breeches, his velvet coat with silver stitching, in favour of a herringbone suit and Oxford brogues. His hair was cut short and slicked back with brilliantine. What a sorry figure he cut compared to the man he had once been. Instead of a sword, he must carry a walking cane. Instead of a tricorn, tabarro, cloak and mask, a humble fedora sat on his head. And where was he to go? The ridotto was long since gone, and the gondolas were filled with tourists. Little wonder then that he was drawn back to the Palazzo Almoro, and to Ginevra, who so resembled his lost Leonora. Ginevra, for that was the young woman's name, had received a telephone call from Maudsley to explain about the man in fancy dress. She didn't pretend to understand it all, but she found Vittorio interesting. He was always impeccably polite, kissing her hand and that of her mother. The old people were charmed by his old-fashioned manners, and declared him a much finer match than Ginevra's current suitor, her cousin, Count Gardiamoro. What a moment that was when the two men first met! By some trick of heredity, Gardiamoro resembled almost exactly the hated Count Armoro of yesteryear. Vittorio trembled with horror and repulsion. Gardiamoro was likewise repulsed. Just who was this odd stranger who was stealing Ginevra's affections? True, Ginevra was a little insipid for the Count's taste, and it wasn't as if he had no other women to warm his bed, but he had his reputation and status to think of. Surely the Armoros would not allow this Vittorio Dandolo to steal away the match he deserved. And what did Vittorio think? Ginevra interested him, yet she was not Leonora. He was unsure what to make of the modern girl who showed herself so shamelessly to the world, talking on the telephone and rouging her lips in public. Where was the subtle language of the fan, the chaste glance from a balcony? The grand romance of old Venice was gone, and with it, yes, Vittorio's desire. He remembered now the words of the scientist Simon Maudsley. Your body will live, but your soul will pay the price. Life may seem empty, bland, colourless. It is even possible you may find yourself without desire of any kind. But he couldn't allow Ginevra to wed Gardiamoro, and so let history repeat itself. This time, Vittorio would be her husband and protector. The necessary desire would come to him once he was married. Perhaps. It was not to be. His new wife expected much more than friendship, but Vittorio had nothing more to give. In time, both grew frustrated. Vittorio thought more and more of the old days, poring over old prints by Canaletto, and toying with the sword that hung on the palazzo wall. Ginevra began secretly corresponding with Gardiamoro. The man might be a cad, but at least he knew how to excite a girl. They arranged a rendezvous in the gardens, one evening when Gardiamoro was taking supper at the palazzo. At an arranged time, Gardiamoro tipped Ginevra the wink and slipped out into the night. When Vittorio realised what was happening, he burned with anger and shame. He chased after Gardiamoro to confront him. You're nothing but a common seducer, he spat out the words. Memories of a previous century loomed in his mind. An empty wine glass. Leonora struggling for her last breath. You will not escape me this time, Count Armoro. With that, he hurled himself at his rival, reaching for a stranglehold. Stop! Stop it, both of you, this instant! Ginevra ran into the garden, her dress flapping. She seized both men by the arms. With a sigh, Vittorio felt the fight go out of him. He dragged his feet back indoors and sank into a chair. Ginevra followed him. So, you're in love with him now? Vittorio didn't even look up. Actually, no, I don't love him. Ginevra's voice began to rise. But I'd rather be with him than in this cold mockery of a marriage. I've been cheated. Do you hear me? Cheated. Please, Ginevra. Vittorio took her hand. Let me try again to make you happy. You make me happy? You, a man without a heart? Ginevra gave a bitter laugh. Slowly, Vittorio got up and made his way to his study. The walls, the furniture, everything seemed bleached of colour. He sat at his desk and took out pen and paper. My dear Ginevra, my life and love are of the past. It was selfish of me to wed you. You deserve so much more than I can give. I am going away now. You will be free. Forgive me. Vittorio. He gave the note to a maid, asking her not to give it to her mistress until morning. Then he dragged out a trunk from under a table and opened it up. Inside it were all his 18th-century effects. There was his coat with the silver stitching, and there in the pocket was the vial given him by Simon Maudsley, only to be used in extreme need. Vittorio unstopped the vial and drank the contents in one draught. He looked about the room. No, he would not die like this. He pulled his old clothes from the trunk and began unbuttoning his jacket. In the meantime, Ginevra's maid had become worried. "The master gave me this. He didn't seem himself," she said. As soon as Ginevra had read the note, she hurried to her husband's room as fast as she could. Vittorio was sitting in an antique chair, dressed in his old velvet suit and lace-trimmed chemise. His face was salt-white, his chest heaved for breath. Tears pricked at Ginevra's eyes. She knelt at Vittorio's side and took his hands. "Vittorio, don't leave me. I was wrong. We can start again." She took his head in her hands and began to kiss him, and in that moment Vittorio was back in the Venice of old, serenaded under the stars as gondolas drifted by. He buried his fingers in Ginevra's hair and kissed her with tender passion. Then the hour struck. Count Vittorio Dandolo, the man without desire, breathed his last. Thank you for listening to Asexual Fairy Tales. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing to the podcast. If you really enjoyed it and want to buy me a coffee, you can do that at ko-fi.com/ElizabethHopkinson48513. Don't forget you can follow me on Twitter at @hidden_grove, or go to my website elizabethhopkinson.uk, where you'll find links to all my books. All the links are in the episode description. I really appreciate all your support. Stay safe and keep reading.